Tech Day Part 1, 10:30 through 12, Monday, March 12, 2018, Room 209 PC. Lesson 1, 2, 3.
Okay, check 1, 2.
I would share some comments of mine, but I'm not sharing time.
Yeah, right. It's your issue. Yeah. This is just like completely separate. Yeah,
okay.
Somebody as a non-executive, he will appoint me as a non-executive director. We pay each other $100, but then we're on the company registers and so on. So we can do this.
Name is almost spelled correctly.
Smart planning.
It doesn't matter.
In case something happens, that's it. There's instructions on what to do. Here's the second. Here's the number. Punch it in.
It's so fun during all these meetings, like getting close and so on. And
that's probably a topic that we're going to do in Barcelona.
As much as us.
Oh, yeah.
Morning, Patrick.
Good morning.
Front, you're all
that one. You answered the question before I asked it. Where do you want us in the first session?
I can read mine.
Okay, good morning, everybody. My name is Ewout Lisse. As you may or may not know, I'm the chair of the Technical Working Group and the managing director of the CCTLD manager for .NA in Namibia. As usual, we do Tech Day on every ICANN meeting on Monday mornings. We have got quite a nice agenda, but before I even go into this, we want to see how many CCTLDs are represented and how many are GTLDs. Can please the CCTLDs, from each CCTLD, one raise the hand, please. 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, because Nigel is not raising his hand. And how many are the GTLDs? That's interesting.
How many of you are warned?
Okay. So the rest are technical community, security, stability, and whatever other SOs they fall under.
There might be subcontractors to the registries in the room running everything from DNS to backends to whatever as well.
Is there somebody who falls into this category? One, two, three. The idea is that we want to see. And we're still doing this under the umbrella of the CCNSO, but feel it's more cross-constituency, and we always wanted to move into supporting smaller GTLDs if they want that support, but maybe we must do more outreach. They probably don't know, or they're bothered, or couldn't be bothered. Anyway, that said, thank you very much. Let's quickly go through the agenda. Patrick Fallström has been briefed or instructed or asked or begged by Mr. Marby to who wrote a letter to the CCNSO about emojis in domain names. So he's going to give us a briefing. We asked him to do that. Wes Hardecker has got a setup at home where he probably has a local copy of a root server or something like this. Didn't really go through this into detail because I wanted to read the presentation and I was a bit preoccupied. So he's going to talk about that. Then Mark Gaudet from CIRA, from .ca, is talking about DNS at the defense layer. If you could have the next slide, please. Lunch, unfortunately, is still self-catering. We haven't managed to weasel into the good graces of whoever sponsors DNS Sec Day. then we always have a host presentation, or almost always. Pablo Rodriguez or one of his colleagues is going to talk about their setup and in particular how it was affected by the hurricane. Given that my business partner died over the weekend, we are starting to look at business continuity. Our CCTLD was not affected because we had started to think about this getting older about a while back already. So we had have processes in place. But this is maybe something that we need to look at on a more broader basis and on a wider basis. What do smaller or medium-sized GTLDs, CCTLDs have in place in case some catastrophe that is unforeseen happens? Are we prepared to deal with these emergencies? At the same time, we will, in Panama, probably have a session about emerging threats. The SSEC is having some thoughts into that, so we'll probably have used this as a focus. So if anybody has some interesting ideas about this for presentation and is coming to Panama, please note that we're going to ask for presentations. Then Warren is going to speak about KSK Sentinel. And then we will hear from the Google Loon project. They're not mad. They are, those are balloons, in case you guys don't know. I saw on the TV 2 days ago about a drone being fired up by a cell service provider to provide a flying cell phone tower. So this is more for internet connectivity, but given the situation we found ourselves in here, or the locals found themselves here, it is quite pertinent, and I'm very grateful to Google to make their speakers available. Then, not Don Hollander, but Mark, what's his surname? He was sitting here just now. Mark is going to speak about universal acceptance. And then we had a cancellation on short notice, so I'm very grateful for Jaromir Talier to offer a presentation about the open source registry software that they're using, which is called FRED. Marieke Keo is going to speak about IDN abuse, and then Jacques Latour is going to speak, give us a follow-up up about his Internet of Things security framework that we heard about last meeting. The transitional break at 15:30, at 15:10, is with intent and malice, because the SSSEC has a conflicting session about, what was it again?
It's on name collisions.
On name collisions. And I didn't pay attention when the program group to which I observed discussed this, so I got basically stuck with having a conflicting session. That's not really a problem. I then obviously had to try to keep the presenters who will go to this meeting away from presenting during the same time. And I also, of course, I don't want anybody to leave, but if anybody wants to attend, we set up a little break that doesn't disrupt proceedings so much. Patrick?
Yes, I also, as the co-chair of that working group, I also want to say that there will be an open ESSEC working group meeting tomorrow. So if it is so the cross-constituent meeting this afternoon will not be the only time when you can interact, I know. So you don't have to go to the meeting if you find this be more interesting. The work party itself will meet, and I'm looking at you, Kathy, in 101B tomorrow from 8:30 to 12:30.
In all fairness, I was prepared to locate the same meeting in our premises and giving away the topics, but then we had enough presenters that we arranged that we do this in collision. This is not ideal, but I will pay more attention next time and fight harder that this doesn't happen again. That said, one more thing. This thing is, we have a remote audience. This thing is live streamed via the Adobe Connect. We're presenting from the Adobe Connect. With one exception, the remote participants will see the same presentation as we do. We had a request from one presenter not to do this. I don't want to go into this in too much detail. We're very grateful that they're coming, so we're not going to argue too much about it. After each presentation, there will be a little bit of time for discussion, and remote questions will have preference.
Thank you very much. Patrick Feldström, member of ESSEC, no longer the chair of ESSEC. Is this what I'm using? Yeah. Ah, cool. So I've been asked to within ESSEC, trying to coordinate the work that we do with internationalized domain names and related issues. We are a few ESSEC people which work on these issues. One of the things that we did last year was that we released document number 95 with a number of recommendations. I will talk a little bit about what the document includes, but it should be sort of relatively well known for the people that know anything about internationalized domain names, and then talk more in general what I believe personally the situation actually is and what's happening with it. So if we look at emojis in DNS, which is a question that's coming up, it is implemented just like all the domain names and all characters we use via a set of rules. And of course, the rules is that this sort of normal motherhood and apple pie, that IDNA is specified by the IETF, and you cannot use emojis. This is sort of, but of course, that argument doesn't really work, doesn't fly. People say, but wait a second, if I use a domain name, it works anyways. For some definition, it works. So, but it's still important for us in the ICANN community to remember remember where those rules are set. They are set by the IDNA standard that is developed in the IETF and by the IETF. And if we look at details regarding emojis and some other symbols, is that they are of the Unicode category symbol other, which also not IETF defines, is actually Unicode Consortium that defines what code point is in within each category. So Unicode Consortium has defined that emojis are symbol other. IETF have said symbol others are not good to have in identifiers, and ICANN have said we follow what the IETF is saying. So the three organizations are sort of following each other. But anyways, let's people just say, oh, but we can ignore that and do things anyway. So, but that is sort of the formal situation. ESSAC did take a look at this, and even though you can just read the standard and spec and say this is actually not possible. So the question then is, but what is really the problem? And there are a couple of issues that I will bring up here. The first one is that emojis are very visually similar. It can be very difficult to distinguish them. The difference between some of the emojis are much more different between different operating systems than what they are than the difference between each other. And this is because one could see the differences between emojis in, for example, Android and iPhones as being font variations for other characters. So it is very difficult to know what emoji is which one. And one example is that there is Unicode Consortium, if you look at their tables, there are more than 20 different emojis which are sort of smiley face or variations thereof. The other thing that ESSAC was looking into, which is not really fun, has to do with composition. Because there are certain emojis that can be glued together with a zero with a joiner. So for example, a man together with a woman, together with a boy, ends up being a family. The question then is, of course, like, and there are no rules that are set on what's happening if you do a combination of other things. For example, what happens if you add a second boy? Would that be a family of four, or will it be a large boy, a very tall one, like Lehman? Or what happens if you have... Yeah, so with the composition, you can see, like, I'm a mathematician at the bottom. You see, you can create all different kind of number of permutations, and it's a little bit unclear what's actually happening if you do these kind of compositions. That's not really fun. Not when you talk about identifiers. We have to remember we talk about identifiers here, not drawing pictures. And then we have this modification, because in Unicode 8, they introduced the ability to apply a modifier that then say that it will actually apply different skin colors to different emojis, for example, by adding one of the skin tones to the code points. But the question then, of course, is what really happens if I change the skin tone of a horse or a house or a car? Is that how you change the emoji to be a blue car instead of a red car? And what if you want more than five skin tones, or if you add two skin tones, or if you do that to the family, or, yeah, anyways. Undefined territory. And when talking about identifiers, me, myself, I don't really like the word undefined. The next thing, which we in ESSAC believe is quite serious, has to do with accessibility. Because the emojis are visual constructs. And there is no standardized way of speak or enter an emoji via voice. And that's not, this ends up being an accessibility issue for disabled people. And we think that is something that should be taken very seriously, specifically when talking about identifiers. So in the report, if you go to the report itself, this is what the five findings that we have in ESSAC. They are disallowed by the IDNA standard. They are not required by design standard convention to be visually uniform or visually distinguishable from each other. Modifiers and glue arrangements of them via the zero with joiner, for example, allows for potentially a much larger set of composed multi-code point symbols. We also found that when you have two domain names which are identical in appearance except for ordinary typographic style variations, but have different underlying code points, which is what ends up happening here, they actually will, by definition, identify two different DNS domains. And so far with domain names, when we talk about font and typographic style and stuff, we have said that that is fine to have a domain name in a red font or green typeface or red typeface. That doesn't change the identifier, but with emojis, it does. That's a very big difference. And finally, from an ESSAC perspective, we do believe that we need to continue the IETF inclusion policy for including code points that we allow in the identifiers we use in the DNS. So because of that, it's just straight unrealistic to expect that just because a code point is included in Unicode, it should be used as part of a domain name. That led us to the recommendations that we have, two of them. Because of the risk, we recommend, we repeat an earlier recommendation that ICANN should sort of course, but we don't really say that in writing, of course not accept TLDs which have code points that are not valid in IDNA 2008, which means we should not even start talking about using emojis in TLDs. And the second recommendation is that we strongly discourage registration of any domain name that includes emojis in any of its labels. Because of the issues that I just described and more. And we advise registrants of domain names with emojis that the domain names that they might have already registered or tried to use or whatever, that they may not function consistently or may not be universally accessible as we expect with the domain names. After we released this report, there are a couple of things that has happened mentioned a few of them. But specifically, there was a board meeting on 2nd of November 2017, and there were four different resolved statements there. Here are two of them that ICANN is now acting on. The first is that the board directs that in conformance to IDNA 2008 and its successor will continue to be a necessary condition to determine valid IDN TLD labels. And from ESSAC, this is something we have been waiting for since, I think, 2002 or something. So it only took about 15 years to actually get this crystal clear from the board, and I think that's a good thing. The second resolution is that the board requests that CCNSO and GNSO engage with ESSAC to more fully understand the risks and consequences of using a domain name that includes emoji in any of its labels and inform the respective communities about these risks. And one initiative that started is that CCNSO and we in ESSAC have engaged with each other, and we will have a discussion on Wednesday in the CCNSO workshop. Where I will actually present the same slide. So for those of you going to that one, it'll be kind of boring, but this is part of the outreach that we're doing. Regarding the first one of these results, let me personally comment on that one. What this one says is that ICANN board is actually recognizing the work that is done in the IETF, and I think this is really, really important. And this is a cooperation that is recognized between the standards organizations that many of us have been looking for, and I'm personally very, very happy to see this engagement because it says very clearly that ICANN board does not see ICANN being the organization that determines what is safe and what kind of characters and code points should be used in the DNS protocol. That is something that IETF decides upon. So for those that would like to have something else than what is recognized, please go to the IETF. That's one way of interpreting the first one of these results. Some more personal comments, last slide, that I think people should be aware of, which explains a little bit how messy the situation is. On the other hand, when I made this slide, the situation was very messy, and I was sort of maybe in a bad mood day and had not had enough coffee. A lot of things actually happens at the moment, so all of these things are on the way to be resolved in one way or another. The first point is something that I would like to make people understand, and that is that the Unicorn Consortium runs an adopt-a-character program. It literally gives the ability for people to pay Unicode and get whatever character they want. Let that sink in. It's a funding model for IFO Unico Consortium. So you go to them, you suggest what character you want, you pay them money, and you get it. Yes, exactly. Is that similar to a process in some other organization we know something about? By the way, it's much cheaper to get a character than a domain than in TLD. Well, there are many. So it gives sort of some interesting flavor to how characters get added to the available characters that we're using. To me, it definitely says that no, we probably should not allow every character and code point that is added to Unicode. I think it's a good thing that we are saying yes or no and have an inclusive program there. Anyways. We have early versions of Unicode 11 is released for comments. Please have a look at those. Please apply the IDNA 2008 rules, which are the normative ones, to that and see what your findings are. Let me know. I am the by IAB appointed expert that also have a look at how the IDNA, at the result of applying IDNA 2008 rules on the Unicode versions, what actually happens. Unicode 11 includes a bunch of new emojis, including a lobster. And you might have seen the tweets from a governor in one of the US states, which are really, really happy that we finally have a lobster in the Unicode code points, because then we can have that as a domain name. He could have got one just by going to Unicode and pay for it. Anyways, so that includes, maybe that would create some pressure, political pressure of using emojis. It's also the case that that there are various parties that including Global Domains International, they had a pre-sale of domain names that include these emojis, and that's a kind of an interesting business model. And specifically, as so, the characters do not exist in Unicode yet, and on top of that, they are not valid according to IDNA 2008, and we still see a market. We see sellers and we see buyers of these domain names, which I think is an interesting market economy situation. And I think we in the community discuss this situation. 161 single emoji of Unicode 11, these code points that do not exist anymore in a version of Unicode that do not exist, was actually sold. On top of that, they were, as we was talking inside ESSAC, we said emojis are so confusable, so not even the registry could keep them apart, because they actually sold the same emoji to multiple registrants, which was interesting. That kind of glitch, of course, is something, is a problem, a mistake that anyone can make. I'm a programmer myself. Oh, I should not talk about what bugs I have in my software. But anyways, it's kind of an interesting situation that when a party tried to sell domain names that did not exist, that are illegal, they also failed. But it happens. We're all engineers. We know that can happen. But what is even more interesting, if we look at W3C, if we look at skin tone and those kind of modifications, at the moment they're looking at adding the ability to have those modifications as part of the style sheet. And let that sink in a little bit. Remember that different skin tones on emojis create not different fonts. It creates different characters in Unicode. Okay? So to be able to know what character you're going to have in an identifier, if it is the case that whatever the text is in the document is changed due to the CSS, you need to have a CSS parser to actually determine what code points we're talking about. That attack vector regarding confusability, I think, is really interesting and could make me sleep really bad at night. It is created to be text decoration, but they are talking about also using those kind of modifiers to force arbitrary characters to be overlaid on others, and that implies, of course, the ability to add modifiers to code points, which is the skin tone, for example, or create a family. Let's say, oh, all Unicode emojis, please add a boy to all of them. Or I want skin tone white or yellow on all the emojis here, including the poop. I don't know what that means. Anyways, that's all. Thanks. Questions?
Thank you very much. Give him a good hand.
Any questions? Please identify yourself for the remote audience and for the transcript.
Yeah. Abdemenem, I can coach. I have one question and then followed by a comment. Let me think out of the box. Could we standardize the shapes across different operating systems and across all devices to have same Unicode and same shape? This is the first part of the question. What is the challenge to do that? Second part, is this will make DNS to accept emoji to be exists online? Third part of the question. My comment, using emoji will bring more people online. I think that. Thank you.
Okay, let me try to understand the questions and give an answer to that. First of all, you talk about I think you ask about the actual design of emojis, whether we could harmonize that across devices and displays. That might be possible to do. I don't really know where that work should be done, if it is in W3C or somewhere else. I see it as somewhat problematic just because... let me take a step back. Yes, it would probably be easy to have it even more harmonized. We've seen the discussion regarding the cheese, whether that is above or below the meat on the hamburger emoji, and it might be possible to harmonize that. But it's not done here in ICANN. It's also the case that I think you are asking a question of whether it's not the case that it's possible to select a subset of the emojis and say these are safe and not include all the emojis, specifically maybe not the ones that everyone is paying for and get their favorite crayfish or something to emojis. That would imply in the standard that IETF start to add individual code points to be allowed in the Unicode in the IDNA standard, and that would practically be work that is done in the IETF. The IETF has so far said that they don't want to do a character by character evaluation. What is a safe character, not safe character? It is complicated enough with, for example, the Arabic script that is used in languages that are non-Arabic, and those kind of problems are things that need to be resolved. Regarding your last comment that more emojis could bring more people online, I might agree with you on that, but I also think that it will also disadvantage everyone that cannot read and type, for example, people with disabilities, so I think that's a big danger. I also think that we should focus on getting all the languages in the world and available in domain names, for example, all the languages on the southern part of India and in Africa that uses the Arabic script. I think that is far more important, and that will bring many, many more people online than what would adding even a single emoji would do. Thank you.
One more question.
Hi, I'm Elaine Proust. I provide some consulting services to registry operators and registrars, some of which are considering offering emoji domains. So you may have already answered this, but I'm wondering if the ASAC or IETF has a safe list or a danger list, and if you're working on that, or maybe you just said that you don't want to undertake that.
The answer is that does not exist, and emojis, just like other symbols, are not included in the IDNS standard. And we do, and in the review that we did in ASAC, we see enormous number of risks to use emojis. And once again, one of the problems is that a typographic change, it has to do with the design of emojis compared to other characters in Unicode code set. A typographic change of the emoji changes the code point. It is similar to as if you change from one font to another one, it will be a different identifier. And that would be a bad thing if a domain name was different if you use it in time or in a serif or a non-serif font. So just the whole design of emojis need to be completely different to be something that can be used. So to me, it's a complete non-starter. That said, if it is the case that work should be done going down this path because people want to use various symbols as part of identifiers, that work must be start in a combination of W3C, Unicode Consortium, and IETF. We don't have the competence here in ICANN to do that, more than, as you say, and as we hear, and as we see, potential market economy forces that would like to do things. But there are many things we would like to do.
Okay, thank you. So you also said
Sorry. We are running over time, so I don't want to have another question.
Okay.
Please.
You
take
can
it
contact
off,
me
take
afterwards.
It offline talk and
to
talk to him,
thank
or
you.
Raise it tomorrow on the next meeting, please. I don't really like to shut down discussions, but we're running a little bit ahead of time. It's much more complicated than it used to be 20 years ago when I created my own little emoji with a stethoscope in ASCII. Anyway, Wes Hardacker is the next presenter.
Thank you very much. So I'm going to talk today about a project that I have at ISI called Local Route. It's sort of in beta at the moment, and it's definitely looking for more information. Oh, clicker. Yes, that would be good. Thank you. And I'm looking for people to play with it and tinker with it and see if it's helpful to you. So we'll go over what it is. So it is basically a project that lets you run a recursive resolver with pre-cached root data, and eventually it'll have other data too for other zones, and we'll get more into that in a minute. So, you know, classic DNS resolution, which I think most people here understand well, the important part is the caching part of it. So as you are, say, sending out www.example.com from your laptop, it goes to your ISP's resolver, typically, and then it goes to all portions of the infrastructure tree. And note that the green com and example.com end up getting cached so that the next time you want to go see a different domain, maybe you go to ICANN.org. Well, none of those are in the cache, so it ends up adding org and ICANN.org to the cache. But if you end up going to exam.com, for example, the com portion is reused. You don't go back to the root in order to go figure out where com is again. So this is standard DNS, you know, hierarchy with caching. So what I'm trying to do with sort of local route is for a domain that you might want, or excuse me, a zone that you might want to have, you know, pre-cached because you use it all the time. And the roots, you know, an example of something that's used all the time. RFC 7706 from the IETF talks about doing caching of the local of the route when you're in bad networks or in bad places. This kind of takes us farther and says, let's just always cache it. Within ICANN, there is a sort of a push to do, there's another project, I think, within ICANN called a hyperlocal route, where they're trying to do other ways to distribute the root data than over DNS directly. And so this is just an extension of that. So in the end, you know, if you are using my local root project, you would have the root zone pre-cached in your resolver ahead of time always. And what that does is it means you basically never contact the root. You never need to anymore. So, you know, if the root went offline, which has never happened, but let's say it did, it actually wouldn't affect you. The one big difference that local root provides over getting data in some other way, because you can actually just transfer the root zone and do this yourself. You don't need it. You can transfer it over HTTP, out of cron daily, or out of, you know, some timer. There's a number of ways that you could do it and then just instantiate the file yourself into your resolver. This gives you notifications. So the instant the root's changed, the notification will arrive to your resolver, and you'll get your resolver will be a request transfer for like AXFR or IXFR or one of the other mechanisms for doing it. And as I said, ICANN actually has a project to try and start pulling root data from other mechanisms as well, like over HTTP directly within a resolver. So what's the benefits of doing this? A couple of things. One, you get sort of the pseudo-caching of the root data. Caching is really not quite the right term there. You're actually running an authoritative copy of the root data for your local network. But we'll just call it caching for ease of understanding. It removes the need to contact the root. I mentioned that. You get faster DNS lookups for the TLDs. Because of caching, that's not going to provide a huge amount of benefit. There's some suggestion that faster NX domains actually help quite a bit, especially if you're on a low latency network, to know that, you know, when somebody starts typing names and your browser starts looking up stuff early, that you'll actually get answers faster that show that domain that they're typing doesn't exist. And then always, you have an always up-to-date copy of the root in case you get connectivity issues with, or, you know, or whatever with the root system, you won't actually need to contact them. And most importantly, I'm trying to enable research of your own. So you can trigger events after, a root zone notification. Since we will be sending you DNS notifies, you can actually do stuff with that metric to say, to go do analysis or whatever else. So I'm actually looking for people that are interested in coming up with new ways to make use of the notification system as well. So a couple of things about security. You do note that the root zone is signed, DNSSEC signed, so that's actually what enables projects like this or any other mechanism for fetching the root data, because it's signed. As long as you check the signatures, you can get it from anywhere that you want. Local root, the way that I've designed the interface, and you'll see pictures of that in a minute, does do data transfers with a tsig that's generated for you, so that the connection between the local root server and your resolver is actually secured with tsig. Because it's DNSSEC signed, that actually doesn't provide you, it's like a double benefit, it's like a double check. It actually doesn't provide you a whole lot of extra security over DNSSEC itself if you validate the data on your resolver side. So I'm not going to do a demo, I'm going to do screenshots instead because it's easier with Adobe Connect. So this is what the website looks like, and it is localroot.isi.edu. You are welcome to go create accounts and sign up yourself, and I'll repeat that again. It's localroot.isi.edu. And you go through the process of typically doing the normal thing. You register with an email address and a password and state that you're not a robot, all those types of things. You'll get the email note saying that you can log in now once you click on a link. And then once you're in the system, there's some links. I know these are small, but the next ones will be bigger. The important one is the getting started link actually walks you through what you need to do. And there's only a few steps. Basically, you create a tsig key, and there's a link for doing that. You create a server, and then it will spit you out some config, as we'll see in a minute. So this is the tsig generation screen. You click Create New tsig. And so tsig is, for those that don't know, is a mechanism for protecting DNS traffic using a shared key. And once you create a tsig key, you can name it whatever you want. It will show you the key, and it'll show you the value. You don't need to copy the value or anything. You just go on to start creating a server. And when you create a server, you're going to give it a name, you're going to give it a IP address, and then it's going to ask you what tsig key you want to use. In the future, some people have suggested, do I have to use tsig? Right now, it's all locked together, and yes, you do. But the reality is, some people may not want tsig enabled, and that's fine. I will make that optional in the future. And then you have a server list. So again, there's my server. It's running at 10.0.0.2, obviously not an address that works on the internet. It's using my cool tsig key. It says it's enabled. It still says the active status still says an X in it. And the reason for that is that I don't actually select it as active and actually send you notifies until we see an initial transfer from you. So actually when you create the config and actually stand up the resolver, one of the first things it'll do is try transfers. And so you'll actually get a transfer quickly, or you can actually run dig to local root to actually get that from the correct IP address to get it active immediately. And I do that to make sure that you're actually using an address that you really are, you own, so that when I get the transfer request from you, I'm not going to send notifies to addresses that you don't own. Note that in the little green line on the far right actually says get config. And so one of the things that you do, if you click on that, you go to this configuration generator. And right now it only does bind, but there's a couple of different bind options. And so this is what it looks like if you select full recursive resolver configuration, meaning it gives you an entire recursive resolver config set that you can just then go throw into bind, and you're up and running. That's it. And in that configuration set, I'm not going to scroll down it, but it includes all of the servers that you can transfer root data from. It includes your tsig key that we were just generated, and it binds the tsig key to the local root server and everything that you need, basically. So it's trying to be as easy as possible for somebody that doesn't necessarily have a whole lot of experience setting up resolvers. At this point, because of its beta status, I'd prefer users that know what they're doing rather than somebody that doesn't have a whole lot of experience running a resolver. So what happens when you run it? Well, this is a graph of real-world effects, and that big downturn right in the middle was where local root was turned on. So this is a recursive resolver. There's not a huge number of requests. This is running in my house, but I'm a geek, and I get a lot of mail, and I've been running a mail server for years. So I'm actually sending, somewhere between, 5 to 40 requests per, I think this is in a minute window, to the root, and I actually... Yeah, I think it is in a minute. Anyway, to the root. And so I actually send quite a few especially because of incoming spam and doing reverse DNS lookups and stuff like that. And that gap in the middle was where local root was turned on, and you can see that it fell too close to nothing. The little tiny blips in the bottom are actually not real requests. That's because I also have a Ripe Atlas node, because I'm a good Ripe Atlas user that likes to contribute data to the internet. And those Ripe Atlas nodes still send queries directly to the roots. So this is actually measured between just me and B-root, by the way. This is not to all the roots. So future work. As I said, this is sort of beta in status. It's been up actually for 3 or 4 months now. I've added a bunch of stuff recently. It's actually being monitored much more than it was in the original, so I'll be notified when there's trouble. I have other people that have offered me VM instances so I can stand up other servers. Right now, there's just a single DNS server that you can slave from. I'm going to add other zones, so rootservers.net and ARPA will come very quickly, actually, probably maybe even by the end of this week, so that you can mirror those as well. And then I'm looking for partners that want to, you know, offer other sources of zones that people really care about or that you might want to do as well. I have a request for students at ISI to help deliver data from that you can get from other TLDs, for example. Obviously, TLDs that are huge, you don't want to do this with .com, not that I can get .com's data, but you would never want to run that, you know, in your local resolver. That's way too much data. But somewhere there's a balance of, there's possibly some ccTLDs that are actually quite small in general that would be worth pulling in as well. I'm looking at other transfer mechanisms, especially with ICANN's actually looking at that, so I'm going to let them do it and hook off of them when they get there. Some variable period update notifications. Because the root actually doesn't change that much, you know, the interesting thing is that you don't really need to pull the data that frequently. You need to pull it on a regular basis for DNSSEC purposes, but you don't need to pull it twice a day if there wasn't any change. So I'm considering playing with sending notifications only when there's change or when on a regular basis that's less than twice a day to get you to update your DNS signatures, because they're going to expire at some point. So some fraction of the root zone signing period. And that'll be a configurable variable on your end. And then the other thing that I'm thinking about adding is some monitoring error reporting, because it's sometimes hard to tell if this is running. When it's in your resolver, unless you're monitoring your traffic, it's actually hard to tell whether your resolver is self-querying itself for root data. So I'm actually thinking about doing some monitoring, at least from some of the sources, to say, you know what, you're still sending data to the roots. We're seeing it through other mechanisms. And that way I can be sure that, you know, so I can actually tell you yes or no whether your service is working or not, or let you know when that status changes. Any questions? Please let me know what you think. There's the address again. I'd love feedback for things that, you know, you might think might be useful additions, or, you know, if you have research focus that you think that this might help with, or you need features, hit me up.
I'm John Levine from MOG. Hi, Wes. This is a dandy idea, but I'm confused. How does this differ from RFC 7706?
It's very, very similar. RFC 7706, if you read the fine text in it, says you are not supposed to do 7706 unless you have a valid reason for doing so. So basically, if you're running on a lossy network or a poor network, and let's just say that the 7706 author told me explicitly I should never call this 7706, so I'm not doing that.
Okay. I'm just saying 7706, even though I do DNSSEC validation, so I don't worry too much about TSIG and stuff like that, and it works fine. And just observed fact is the root zone changes twice a day, even if it doesn't change. They update the serial number. So.
Right. No, I said that. But that change is actually useless to you to a large extent, because there's no data changes. So the change, if I look into, and I assume you're referring to the variable period updates, there's a couple of reasons for doing that. One is that if you're on a really bad link, you actually don't need the new data, because the DNSSEC signatures are valid for a long time, and the new SOA record won't help you too much.
Yeah.
You need some changes on your side, too. That's a longer-term project. The other thing is that you may want notifications only when data actually changes from a research point of view, rather than going to look yourself. I may actually be able to send DNS notifies to people to say, hey, by the way, you know, something just changed in the root that wasn't signature or SOA related and wasn't boring, in other words.
Yeah, no, I'm just wondering, I presume my client is doing ICSFIRST, the actual amount of data is low. So I'm wondering, I understand if it's a lossy network, like every connection is painful, but like in the normal world, how much of this is sort of is a practical advantage, and how much is just you know, it's cool?
No, that's a good question. And some of it comes from, were you in Oark or no?
No.
So I've given two presentations in the last month that talks about privacy aspects, and one of the ways to make sure that you never, you know, leak data is don't ask questions. So if you have all the answers ahead of time, there's actually a privacy benefit there, it turns out.
Oh, yeah, I think there's, even though I have a small network, I think there are,
yeah.
You know, I ignored Warren's advice, and I slaved the root anyway.
Well, there you go. So if you want the notification, you can sign up for here, and that's up to you.
Jeff Osborne, Fruit. Hi, Wes.
Hi, Jeff.
I got to ask this. If this is wildly successful, do you think it would have any impact on the global root server system, and do you feel like commenting on it?
That's a good question. I mean, so for those who don't know, I'm actually the operationally in charge of USC's root service. So in some extent, I'm actually taking myself out of the business if I, you know, this becomes successful. I doubt it because... It would have to get deployed in, like, you know, by default in CentOS or something like that, and I would have to work with vendors that would want to do that. But so that, you know, there's a lot of work going on. So one of the rationales for doing this, there's a lot of thought of, are there alternate methods for distributing root data besides, you know, the way we're doing it now? So this is a toy to experiment with that, and if it became wildly successful, we'll all need to work together to make it wildly successful.
Yeah, you might look into planning for crazy success. It's happened before on the internet.
It has, and I have thoughts around it, but yeah.
Paul Auger's a CentOS vendor, I guess.
Yeah. I said that because you were in the line. You know.
So how is this different from AXFR plus Servstale?
So really the notification is the only major difference. So you, as I said, you know, before, you can actually functionally slave from the roots today. If you, because there's a list of roots that will give you that you can do AXFRs from today. And in fact, if when you get the local root config dump, it actually has all those too. So it's, you don't just, you know, you can't just pull from us. We actually give you a whole bunch of other places so that you can do this safely. If any of them went offline, if local root died, the config would still work because you'd still getting data, because you'd still do SOA checks in order to figure out whether your data was up to date and that kind of stuff. So with respect to Servstale, Servstale will work up until some, you know, combined period of time. It's there is no different.
But if all root servers would just open AXFR, we have like what 6,000 points we can AXFR from. Like I'm not sure how this is really different.
It's not significantly different. This makes it easy to do. So there's only a couple things. I said this in the beginning, right? That people already do this. You can already do this with your zone. That was like one of the first statements I made. You can dump the root zone config in and slave it from any of the roots that allow AFXR, of which there's a few, plus ICANN servers that let you do it. So that's easy. You're done. This provides notifications, which you don't get through the other mechanisms. You know, your server has to do SOA checks and things like that. But who cares? You know, that's like an hour delay or something like that. This makes it insanely easy. Most people don't know how to add that zone. I actually dump config for you so that you can just copy and paste it in. It's an ease of use thing too. So some of it's publicity, right? I want people to start slaving. You know, I want people to start doing AXFRs, and this is a way to make it easier to get more people to try it and experiment with it.
Hi, Dwayne Wessels from Verisign. So you had a slide that talked about benefits. And I get skeptical about projects that only list their benefits. If this is all benefits, then, you know, why aren't we doing it? So are there any downsides to doing something like this?
Yeah, there is. You can, I mean, just let's tech, I lost the benefits slide. So that's a good point, and I should create a list of downsides. The most obvious one being if you are not a resolver expert and you tinker with config and, you know, you don't succeed in a transfer, you don't realize that, you know, you need to deal with large TCP transactions through a firewall, you know, you're running a new service, a new, you know, copies of something, so you'd better know what you're doing because you could break your resolver. And so if you're going to do this on a major ISP, be careful.
Okay.
You could always do it in one resolver in your ISP and not with another if you want to, you know, tinker with it for a while, but no, that's a valid point. I'll work on creating a detriment slide. Risks would be a better word, probably.
Yeah, Abdelmanem, I can coach. I assume that I am the resolver at the ISP, so I will exhaust myself to looking for the cache for the query, and at the same time, I have the root zone, local root zone at my site. So I think there is no need for cache now, or somehow other client maybe have the same local root zone, and no need for cache. By the way, I don't trust the ISP. So it is meanwhile for me to have local reserve, local root zone at my own machine.
Yeah, you can. There are mechanisms for standing up local resolvers on your infrastructure yourself, be it a laptop or a server or whatever. It's more difficult on some operating systems than others, but in many times for things like in a Linux-based desktop, you can just install namd and it's up and running pretty much, and then copy config from here. So it's very easy on some instances and not on others. I don't know how to do it on Windows because I never have, but I know it's possible. Warren's going to tell me how to do it on Windows.
Oh, God, no. So, Warren Kumari, Google. I was one of the original authors of 7706, and a few people have said that I'd suggested against doing it unless you had a really good reason. I don't think that's quite correct. The document kind of says that, because the document had to say that to get published.
Right, and so I wasn't blaming it on you. Yeah. I wasn't blaming it on the authors. I was saying that the authors were told that had to go in there. And that's
and so, yeah, I mean, this is basically 7706 with notifies and automated magic. So this is, I think, you know, wonderful.
Thank you. Now I'm in trouble.
very quick comment. You mentioned tsig, you know, not much benefit. I think one thing is that it gives you a slightly stronger guarantee of freshness if there's a man in the middle on
I mean, there's
so
other
you might
things.
Want to
mention
that.
No, that's true. It does help you in a couple other ways, especially because most resolvers, most authoritative engines don't check via DNSSEC validation. So unless you turn that on, a lot of them just take the zone data from their master and serve it anyway. So
this is Schumann. So I just wanted to.
Well, David Lawrence, I just wanted to say that I don't have a very good reason for doing it, and yet I'm doing it. And I'm making this public declaration that if you want to sick the IETF RFC police on me, I'll be your test case.
Well, thank you for doing it, but appreciate it.
This is Schumann, Salesforce. So I just wanted to follow up on the TSIG point, and this is something I pointed out on the RSAC caucus mailing list recently. TSIG does provide additional protection for transfers of of a full zone, because remember, DNSSEC by itself only signs authoritative data in the zone. The root zone is full of non-authoritative data, such as child NS delegations and glue records.
That
so
is a
if
valid
you want
point.
To be sure that you have obtained the root zone correctly, you need a channel protection mechanism, and TSIG is the sort of DNS protocol resident channel protection mechanism. So I would recommend that if you're going to do 7706, you need TSIG or you need some alternate way of verifying it, such as HTTPS. I think you mentioned that as a possibility too, right?
No, that's a very, very valid point. Thanks very much.
Right. We have an online question. If someone wanted to learn more about ICANN's hyperlocal root project that you mentioned, I believe the answer is talk to the ICANN office of the CTO, but if you could specify.
I don't know the right contact point. I believe that would be a good place to ask because they would know where to point you. I don't think that project is at the point of deployment yet, so I think you'll hear more about that once their side code projects are done and completed and deployed. So, good question, though.
Okay, thank you very much. Give him a big hand. One of the rare cases where a short presentation generated more debate than the length of the presentation, which is very good. Because I like a little bit of interaction that we don't get fall asleep all the time. Next one will be Mark Gaudet from CIRA and talk about DNS as a defense layer. And we are 5 minutes ahead of time, so no problem. Where is the clicker? Here is the clicker.
Okay. Thank you very much. My name is Mark Gaudet. I'm a product manager at CIRA, and I'm responsible there for DNS services that we launch. We run some TLD DNS as well as an Anycast DNS service within Canada. And what I'm going to do today is talk about, share our experience launching a DNS security product in Canada. So it's a
cloud-based DNS firewall, share with you what we learned launching the service and what our vision is for the service going forward. So cybersecurity, like everywhere in the world, is a big challenge in Canada. We recently did a survey of more than 2,000, roughly 2,000 businesses in Canada. And from the feedback and results from 1,000 businesses, the results aren't surprising. Most organizations use firewalls, they use antivirus software. But what is surprising is 19% of the respondents from this survey said they were victims of a ransomware attack, so one in five. As well, 32% of the respondents also said they were a victim of a phishing attack where they actually gave up information from inside their network to hackers. So there's a major gap. There's still room for improving security. And what one way to do that is through DNS. So DNS is used by every application, malicious or good. 91% of malware uses the DNS for command and control. So by looking at the DNS, you can have a view of what's happening in the network, what malware is operating by observing the DNS queries. The good thing, it covers all devices, doesn't require any new software. It works for everything. Gives you a view of all traffic within the network. So one of the ways to leverage DNS to build a security product, this isn't new, there are products out there, is with a DNS firewall. So at the core of it, in the purple, is a policy-enabled DNS server. So on the right is the corporate network sending out, or customer network sending out DNS queries. The policy-enabled DNS server examines all the queries and compares them to a threat list, as well looks at the responses, the IPs that come back in the DNS query response, to see if those are on the threat list as well. So it provides a mechanism there at the DNS level to examine and block DNS queries. That's at the enforcement, the ability to report what is blocked and why, providing information that could be used to mitigate. We looked at building, we have approximately 250 organizations using an authoritative Anycast service. So they started to come to us asking about recursive DNS and if we could offer a service. So we, in that exploration, we realized there was a requirement in Canada, a need for a secure recursive DNS service that could also do content filtering. We looked at building that ourselves. We looked at Bind. We looked at doing some custom development. But what we quickly realized was that the real value in a DNS firewall or any other security product is the threat feed. How is that threat feed produced? How dynamic is it? What is the data used to produce that threat feed? So we realized that we weren't going to be able to... We looked at public feeds, commercial feeds we could buy, and what we realized was whatever we produce was not going to have much incremental value from services that were already being used for security. So we needed something that had a different threat feed. We went out into the market and looked at different companies, and what we ended up partnering with Nominum, which has now been acquired by Akamai, so I'll use those interchangeably. Nominum sells recursive DNS software to large service providers globally, and what that gives them access to is large amounts of DNS data. So they answer in the orders of trillions of DNS queries. They take a subset of those queries and get an anonymized feed from all of their ISP customers, and analyze that to produce a threat feed. So that was the real reason we chose Nominum, was that they had access to data and the ability to produce a high-quality dynamic threat feed. And they add an average of 100,000 domains to the threat feed each day. So this just, I could spend a whole presentation on just how the threat feed's produced, but in general, at the top, they have the service provider data, which is roughly 1 million DNS queries per second coming into their data science center. They
combine their data science with commercial and public threat feeds to produce a dynamic threat feed that we receive at our policy-enabled DNS server, which is Nominum software. So one of the things they focus on is newly seen domains. So if a domain has not been queried in the last 60 days, it's automatically suspicious and is analyzed. And within 14 minutes of being seen for the first time, if it is malicious, it will be added to the block list, and we will start blocking it. So real value is that it's really dynamic. So just to give you a little bit of information on the service we launched, we've taken the Nominum Akamai software and built a cloud service in Canada operated by CIRA. We launched it in June. We have 80 organizations live on the service at this point. Behind those 80 customers are more than 500,000 network users. That's because much of our base is in the public sector, large universities, school boards with tens of thousands of users in each of those networks. We're currently running at a peak of 3,000 queries per second, so starting to generate a lot of traffic. On an average month, last month, well, we're growing, so in February we blocked a million malicious domains. The threat feed is very dynamic, and over that month, 5 million new domains were added to the threat feed. We do trials as well, and 100% of all networks that have turned on this service and have seen blocks, so there are things in their network that are, have been identified as a threat from the threat feed. As well, we've talked to lots of organizations, and they still see a gap in their existing security solutions, and leveraging DNS as an incremental layer of protection has been very well accepted in the organizations I've talked to. One of the things that was a concern was false positives, so that hasn't been an issue. For the number of users we have behind the service, we might get an average of one or two queries per week, which are, hey, this domain is blocked. Why is it blocked? And each time we do an investigation, there is a valid reason for it being blocked, and a lot of confusion happens when a customer has a site that they've commonly gone to and used. An example would be an education, a school board where someone was downloading educational materials one day. The next day the site's blocked, and it was because that site had been compromised and was now distributing malware. So it requires some level of support to analyze the sites that are blocked. So I'll shift a little bit to what we learned in launching the service and operating it since June of this year. Some of the operational requirements, customer experience and benefit, as well the what we receive as a view on the threat landscape in Canada by having access to this DNS data. And as the registry for Canada, what benefits it's brought us in being involved in this service and operating it. So one is operational. A recursive DNS service is open to attack. Our service is whitelisted for only the organizations and networks using it, but we still see attack traffic. So this is a graph of blocks related to mostly pseudo-random subdomain queries that have been blocked by the service. So these are relatively small given the capacity we have, but it is a fact that it will be attacked, and we have functionality within the service from Nominum Akamai that does detect pseudo-random subdomains and blocks those and applies rate limiting to different malicious traffic directed at the service. As well, as a CC operator, we have no experience in operating a recursive service. We know what kind of traffic we'd expect at the authoritative level, but not at a recursive level. So this graph shows you from the time of launch the average query rate over 24 hours. So starting out in the hundreds to, you know, over the past month, we're averaging 1,500 queries per second, and with a peak of 3,000 roughly. So that what we've done to try to figure out how many networks we could support and what types of networks we could support is to do some capacity modeling. So this shows the number of network, how many queries per second per 1,000 network users. So at the top, a school board is generates a fairly low number of queries. So that's like 1 to 2 queries per second per 1,000 children at a schools. So we can support lots of school boards. At the bottom, you have an ISP. We have some small ISPs using the service, up to 10,000 subscribers. And the difference there is they don't forward queries. They send the queries directly to us. So they're roughly 30 queries per second per 1,000 users. And then you get a range in the middle between cities using it, municipalities, universities, or commercial businesses. So what we've been able to do there is take our capacity of 200,000 queries per second and be able to map that into how many of each type of network user we can apply to the service. From a customer perspective, they will see a dashboard that shows them their DNS query traffic plus the number of blocks for each type. So in the middle, the orange is malware and phishing, is phishing domains in particular, domains that a user has clicked on. And then on the right is botnet blocked. Those would be malware acting and sending out command and control DNS queries, for example. And then this gives the counts by threat type. If you look on the right, the threat names, broad categories of threats, which include, you know, devices being used for Bitcoin mining, ransomware, different types of malware that are found on a hospital network over the period of 30 days. And what we, one of the values of this service is it provides us a view of the threat landscape in Canada. As, you know, we're just starting out, but with 500,000 network users, that's a fairly broad, spread geographically across Canada. That gives us an interesting view on the threat landscape in Canada, what's happening, what threats are appearing. So this is an aggregate view. At the bottom, the different colors are the different types of threats that are shown here from January to the end of February. And if you, showing in the next slides, I'll turn off. So one of the things we quickly saw in when we started looking at the data in January was every single network that was using our service was, we were blocking Bitcoin mining. So sites that were using user PCs, resources to do Bitcoin mining. So that really peaked in January, and then it dropped off. So lots of, we could dig into that data further and try to figure out why it dropped off. Was it starting to be blocked by other security products? But it's very interesting. We'll see things happening very quickly. We saw that before it was in the press and visible. This shows just blocks associated with Mirai. There's a steady state. If I extended this into March, you'll see a steady state of queries. A lot of these are more in an ISP and home users, but then there's a big peak at the end of February. General, some of these are grouped into more general categories, so malware, call home. You can see there was something popped up at the beginning of February where there was a large number of queries. So we really get a good view of all of the malicious queries that are being blocked, which provides information on what's happening in Canada. And it provides lots of interesting opportunities to do some research on the data, as well as identify new threats specific to Canada. So we have access to the data, or starting to do some data science on it, where we would start to look for things that aren't on the threat feed that are specific to Canada. It provides us an opportunity to inform and educate, so when we see specific threats that are occurring, we can provide outreach to Canadians in general, Canadian organizations in general, or to users of our service to tell them about specific threats that are showing up, what they can do to prevent them. If it hasn't hit them, here's what is happening across the country. We also, in discussions with organizations using it, universities, for example, that use the service, one of their biggest threats is phishing. And it could be, we block phishing domains, but some could be very specific to Canadian universities. There's an interest among the university community to share information. So if they identify a specific phishing domain, we'll create the ability for them to share that information, to quickly block it on our service, and to have that protection from that more quickly. And it also has really changed CIRA's role in Canada with respect to cybersecurity. We're starting to be in discussions with other groups in Canada within the government and in not-for-profits that produce threat feeds, where we will incorporate their threat feeds into the service to add more of a Canadian flavor to it. So going forward, the vision for, we started out this as primarily a commercial service. There's some, we are trying to diversify revenue, so we do have an interest in selling it. But we're also seeing that we, now that we have access to the data and we are operating this service, there's a lot more we can do with it. And we will push it to share that information, keep data sovereign as well in Canada. There's an interest in keeping the DNS query data in Canada and answering those queries there. As CIRA and a not-for-profit, we aren't going to commercially sell that data. We will keep it private, and there is a trust level there for us to use it to improve security in Canada. As I said earlier, we'll augment that with specific Canadian threat data that we can get access to, and look to provide longer-term, leverage this technology to provide more of an open service for home users all across Canada. So some of the things, just to conclude, the partnership we came up with, Nominum and Akamai, really helped us move forward to quickly. So we've taken what is an enterprise carrier-grade service and deployed it very quickly within Canada and built a cloud service there. DNS as a layer of protection, as one layer in a defense in depth strategy, is really gaining momentum. There's more than 50 organizations that are paying for this service as a commercial service, so they believe that it can incrementally improve on their firewall and existing security. And we see there's a benefit as a CC to operate this service within Canada, to own the DNS data, query data, and to be able to leverage that for research and to improve the security of Canada's internet. And I see the DNS data as a hugely valuable resource that we can leverage. So, and that's it. I'll happy to take questions.
Thank you very much. I think he deserves also an applause. And I abuse now the prerogative of the chair and ask a question from the rostrum. A small ccTLD like .na, where we basically, when we see this, we manually block /21 sometimes, just to punish the owners. How can we use such a system?
We could take that offline. So there is...
No, don't take it offline. I'm not the only manager of a small ccTLD, yeah. And it's... I think it's a pertinent question. We don't have the financial resources to contract with big providers. Fortunately, Nominum is one of our Anycasting secondaries, so maybe we can talk about it. But I would like to hear what you suggest for small CC or other GTLDs, especially ccTLDs in developing countries.
So one of the ways we could help out as CIRA is that this is implemented as a cloud service. It's easy to extend it into another country. So we could host a recursive service that's fed by the threat feed in another country and make that available and make it part of our operation. That's one of the reasons I'm here presenting this is, A, we'd share our experience, and as well, if someone was interested in deploying this, we have the capability to help them do that.
Okay. So this service is
I think, clearly aimed primarily at being the last hop iterative resolver, right? So the applications go directly to your resolver and you see what traffic they're asking for. If I put another resolver between the application and your resolver, things like query minimization come in, and you might not always block a lookup at the zone apex, but if you want to go deeper into the zone, you might not see those queries. They might go to an authoritative server if there's another resolver downstream from you. Question, do you also envision serving intermediate resolvers downstream, RPZ, redistribution, or anything like that?
The way the service is typically deployed now is most organizations, all of the organizations using it, have a recursive server inside their network, and they've configured it to forward the queries to us. And they would lock down the DNS to only allow queries to this service. So they would cache locally forward to us.
Okay, so you do the minimization for them, but they expose the full queries to you.
Yes.
Okay.
Wes Hertiker, USCISI. Unless I missed it, you didn't define what actually blocking does. I assume you're returning an NX domain to the...
If it's malware, like a non-user, it gets back a serve fail. If it's a user, like a phishing domain, for example, there is a proxy server as part of this service, so it will get redirected to a block page to let the person know. It also does content filtering, broad categories of content filtering, and that will have a content-focused block page.
Yeah, I was thinking specifically in the context of a DNSSEC-enabled validator sitting behind that was forwarding through your resolver and what that would look like to them. But a serve fail would still end up being a serve fail in either case.
Jörg Schweiger with DENIC. As you obviously are in a position to identify and to block domains, don't you fear that you are being asked to take them down? And seen as a sensor of a net?
Not at this point. So all the organizations using this, they own their network. They're turning it on and choosing to block and enforcing acceptable use within their networks. So we have not hit, and as well, we're not doing active research yet on the data we receive to identify anything new. Things that aren't, we're receiving the block list from Akamai and enforcing that. So the censorship is already being done in the networks that we work with. They're already using firewalls to block domains. They're doing content filtering. They're doing custom blockings of specific domains. And this is another mechanism they can use.
All right. Not sure.
Any more questions? I would like to repeat the exercise we did earlier when we started, when the room was only half full. How many CCDLEs are represented here now? Don't tell me it's less than before. Subcontractors for GTLDs and they raise their hand together with the GTLD, please, so that they can. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. The obvious question is we want this to be cross constituency. So is there something, please think about it, if there is something that you feel we can do to engage more or to increase the percentage of GTLDs, especially smaller and new GTLDs. Maybe take this thought with you for lunch, and you can contact us at CCNSO Tech Day. The emailing address is open so that you can basically post to that list. It's not a closed list. We have a separate address for internal business, but if you post to that list, you are allowed to post and we get it. That said, thank you very much. Go and have lunch on your own expense.
How was that? So we had a group. We really had a group of six people in there who failed out. Came up with an excuse. I know. So we ended up with five people who went to the car. And they get half up $90.
Not $90.
We wanted to do the cave as well.
One, two.
Yes, so just around the corner here. Let's book and swing past.
Can we?
All right.